Some people's stories. Like me, but before I was born, Elizabeth was kicked out when she had no intention of leaving. She was supplementing her brethren's social schedule by practicing with a ladies' singing group, though. She knew that joining groups and clubs was forbidden. It was being unequally yoked with unbelievers. Elizabeth writes,
Dave and I got kicked out of fellowship. I got kicked out for joining the Sweet Adelines, and Dave for joining the Barbershoppers. We lived in a small town outside of Toronto and went into the meeting every Sunday to Toronto. I didn't have any other outside interests. We didn't go to movies, we didn't drink, so we didn't go to bars. Dave went golfing a couple of times a year. He would have been put out of fellowship had he joined a golf club, though. Our children were 5 and 7 years old at the time. Donald remembers a lot of it, but Carolyn doesn't remember it at all. The overseers stopped Dave after the meeting one Sunday morning and said they would like to meet with him. Dave wanted to know what was on the agenda, but they wouldn't tell him. A few days later, one phoned and said it was because of his singing group. At this stage, they didn't know I was in one as well. Dave made an appointment finally with them and went to the hall to meet them. They told him if he didn't leave the singing group, they would withdraw from him. Dave's attitude was, where do I sign? Of course, his father was an overseer in it over in Scotland, one who thought very highly of himself, I might add. They wanted to see me because they had to treat both as individuals. Dave said, definitely not. You have caused enough grief for our family. Then they were getting out their diaries to make another appointment with Dave. Dave said, no, it is over. All of this took place over about 8 months. I could not believe they would do this. But then I thought, if it isn't a singing group this week, what will it be next week? I started going to the local Baptist church and put the children in Sunday school. We have had a much happier life than we would have had serving the Lord with them. They sent us this letter that said we were heretics. As soon as I saw that, I thought, these people are crazy. I had been very upset, but after I saw that, I dried my eyes. I vowed I would not bring my children up in a negative atmosphere. It was all very difficult because all of my family, including both sets of grandparents, were overseers and leaders. When they were alive, people got saved and came into fellowship. After they died, their watchword was, occupy till I come. That meant doing ineffective things like preaching to a lamppost beside a huge bank of snow in the middle of January, holding many pink teas for the saints, etc. Thus endeth the lesson.
About this, Dan, originally from the Renton Exclusive Brethren in Australia, writes,
This is why it's of utmost importance to have our salvation, faith, trust, and personal link in Christ, and not place it in any particular church group we may go to. Renton Exclusive said to us when we were leaving, You belong to the brethren, as in, you belong to our group of brethren, as if faith and salvation should be placed with the group. I responded, No, I belong to Christ, which was met with silence. The only way I can describe the general feeling about our new Christian life after 2011 was like awakening from a long hibernation in a dark cave.
I'm sure Plato could relate. As near as I can tell, Rentons fall about halfway between TW's and Taylor Hale's brethren as to strictness and legalism. Well, maybe about 75% of the way to being Taylor Hale's from being Tunbridge Wells, to be more precise. These things are certainly moving targets. Jacqueline posts on Facebook many years after cutting her Taylor Hale's Exclusive Brethren hair and no longer daily wearing the mandated token of subjection everywhere she goes.
Was glad to wake up this morning and find there was no subjection bow in my hair. Spent a lot of the night dreaming that I was living in the world but still was wearing it.
Decades after leaving, Bonnie, from a group that mandated the wearing of scarves rather than subjection bows, and then only to go to meeting, says,
I have a reoccurring nightmare that everyone is walking out the door to drive to meeting and I can't find a scarf. I can't tell you how many times I've dreamed about wearing scarves, buying scarves, you name it.
The latter is the Brethren Woman's equivalent of the dreams I have where I'm at work and I'm desperately looking for my missing pants. I'm not sure I can convey to anyone who's never been in a legalistic exclusive system what it's like to leave or be kicked out. It's an odd bond to be in to begin with. And as I said already, having it severed is quite a bit like being divorced against your will. It had been meant to last until death or rapture did bring you together with Christ, but now all that was being sundered, and you would have to stand awkwardly avoiding eye contact in heaven for all eternity over this. Louisa writes,
"My insides knew I was bound and in chains. I just had no clue where the door was to exit, and had no permission to exit. All I saw was walls. I had to get to the point where staying was worse than leaving, with their criticism following me, and with the unknown in the outside Christian world. As I did not leave with the division, I left alone. A few left that meeting over incest, where the brothers of the gal were supported, the gal thrown out in shame, and I saw that they survived leaving, which no doubt helped me to contemplate the unthinkable, leaving."
Mary says that her parents continued to be a disproportionately unhealthy central concern as to life choices well into her adult life. She writes,
"If not for my parents and their feelings and image, I'd probably have left 5 years earlier, at least. I did grow beyond it quite a bit, though, once I left. Took a few years to not have the guilt come back in spades, but it's virtually gone now. Much more confidence as to my choices and my ability to stand behind them."
Jake, though only 20, already says this about an overfocus on pleasing his parents.
"It isn't a huge part of decisions I make anymore. What changed this for me was making my faith my own, and I think this was fast-tracked because of how strongly I felt against a lot of the things that they believe. I was forced to find it for myself or wind up somewhere else because I couldn't subscribe to a lot of the things that I was taught. How would you grow beyond this a bit? Start by recognizing that it's choking you. Be your own person and start to have a personal relationship with a living God who has a voice and feelings and he wants to interact with you. Stop trying to have a relationship with your parents' set of beliefs and calling it Jesus."
Laura says,
"My parents are really very cool people. The TW thing is this crazy blind spot and has remained my albatross over the years. Even today, I find myself in a love-hate tailspin with all things churchy that eats away at my faith by displacement."
Anne says,
"Unlike you who are still wrestling with your upbringing, I have just walked away from it completely. It was too icky to deal with it. I still talk about it from time to time, but most of the time I just live in a completely different world, one where things are much simpler and more beautiful. When I visit my parents, I have to limit the length of time and also focus on staying connected to my new worldview, or else I get depressed. I think that working through the old stuff would strengthen me in the face of their persistent religiosity that I can avoid from a distance. However, I mostly find it so dumb that I can't be bothered."
Some people claim they can just walk away from our culture, but for many, the loss of their birth culture and what they think of as their spirituality is keenly felt. The disqualification from the dating and gene pool is just the tip of the iceberg there, but if you are out, your chances of marrying someone who is in are pretty much rendered nil. Many of us were kept in line mainly through that fear of being kicked out. Fletcher says, "I've been away from that garbage since 89, and I'm still screwed up." Darlene says,
"When I was excommunicated from the Brethren, it was harsh and cruel. I felt thrown away, thrown right out into the world I was taught to stay away from. I felt displaced, didn't know where I belonged. Everything I was used to was ripped right out from under me. Friends I had in the meeting for 17 years suddenly stopped talking to me. I was no longer welcome in their homes. I was told by a leader of the Brethren that in Bible times I would have been stoned. My parents stayed away from me. The rules that kept my family and friends away from me when I was shunned caused a loneliness that resulted in despair. Life felt like it was over, and I was only 17 years. When I returned to meeting, hoping for reconciliation, none was offered. I was forbidden to go to any social gatherings, including young people's meetings. Yet I was told I had to return to the meeting to be back in God's will. Nothing made sense. After 17 years of torment at home and then at meeting, This led me into discouragement and despair. I then turned to another pathway. What choice did I have?
Some, like Laura, leave our Brethren group only to watch the contagion of legalism spread to what should ostensibly be an open Brethren group. Laura says,
"It's good to be loved. I cling to the only right place baggage and find I am Brethren to the core. I hate where we are because they're pushing one right place dogma gospel hall style. But I can't feel comfortable elsewhere, even if they treat us with love, because it's not right enough. But we are wrong here too. So it seems like a choice between wrong and loved and wrong and hated."
A really nice old man named Ray Land once gently objected to my use of the words kicked out, wanting me to say that I was temporarily under discipline. He'd come over and asked me, in his assembly in America, why I had not partaken of bread and wine that Lord's Day morning, though I was clearly an adult. Was I saved? He expressed polite disbelief at my answer. In his exclusive TW assembly, young people confessed to premarital sex and other such crimes and simply had to sit back Lord's Day morning for a month or so and then were back in. So that was his world. Forgiveness. Openness. My cultural habitat was very different from Mr. Land's, though we both went to TW assemblies. He really had no idea what went on in various of the other assemblies. This is the case with many in-Brethren people. And what was simply my own experience and grim reality for my family and friends pierced to the heart of Mr. Land's view of his culture. To contemplate the idea that we might be tossing people over the side if they didn't fit in and toe the line, though they'd done little of consequence, was something he had to reject as a concept. He believed our culture would only put someone under discipline for a few concrete, easily defined sins as laid out in Scripture: fornication, adultery, extortion, drunkenness, rape. Stuff on the list right there in the actual Bible, not random other stuff. Mr. Land also simply could not believe that where I'm from, people get kicked out for life, for wholly subjective, not playing well with others reasons, for personality flaws, that assemblies would not only never seek to restore someone, but that they'd actually refuse to meet with the person to discuss his situation even when he asked. But again, it's what we grew up with. But he couldn't believe it, wouldn't believe it, because that wasn't fair. And the Brethren were terribly fair, weren't we? He'd been coming out to meetings most of his life. 3 times as long as I've been alive, certainly. The idea that for some of us the system not only wasn't fair, but was proving unworkable, troubled him deeply. He had to reject that whole idea. My experience had been different from his. There were always a couple of old people sitting in the back section of our meeting hall on Sunday. And if kids asked why they were back there, often their parents didn't really even know why these people were in the penalty box to perpetuity. In some cases, the best answer we got was, apparently he had a problem personality when he was younger and was quarrelsome when they attended out east. Funny, no one had heard him say a word in recent decades, and he'd come out every week for 20 years so he could sit in the back and not take communion. And he always took his wife and politely left if we were having food after, because they weren't welcome and were never going to be. And then, eventually, people like this died, still shrouded with that vague cloud of infamy. Often the decision regarding these old-timers had been made by men who were now dead, and no one really wanted to undo that decision. The guys who gave me the hey-ho heave-ho aren't quite dead yet, but I expect the same grandfathering of their administrative decisions will be done in my case. A guy I used to know years ago, who I'll call Luke, moved to a tiny assembly with only a couple living people left. They were all women, but Luke, so he was instantly in charge of everything, though not 30. Luke started to meet with an old man there who'd been out for 25 years. Luke wanted to know why the old guy was out. Immediately, Luke received a deluge of long-distance phone calls warning him not to meddle in this matter and sarcastically asking him if he thought he knew better than the hey-hos who'd remotely put this guy where he was back before man had walked on the moon. There was also the suggestion that this man was evil and might curse people. Apparently, this man had been known to tell people in authority that God might make his displeasure with their legalistic behavior known. And apparently, bad things had happened to some of these power folks. Certainly, this old guy had managed to live longer than many of his accusers, than all three of the Hayhoe brothers, for example. So several upstanding Brethren men had felt like the guy was cursing people and gave Luke dire warnings of this. He wasn't a witch, but they dressed him up like one. But Luke decided to let the men back in anyway, as he seemed like a perfectly ordinary old Christian gentleman. The old man started breaking bread with the mini-assembly again. And nothing happened, besides slightly less tedious Bible discussions, there now being two men talking at them, where there'd been one carrying on the discussion before. Of course, the man's dead now. Natural causes, one presumes. As to leaving, Ruth writes,
"Just wanted to throw in my 2 cents worth about what leaving versus being kicked out, which I had feared all my life, meant for me. Leaving, for me, equates to one of those horror stories you read about, with a hiker or a woodsman alone in the woods, trapped by a fallen tree. There is no one to rescue him or hear his cries for help. The only way he is able to free himself is to amputate one of his own limbs. If he does not, he will remain trapped, and he will die slowly of starvation and exposure. If he does escape by mutilating himself, he will run the risk of bleeding out. He will leave a part of himself behind that he will never get back, and he will be permanently disfigured and disabled. No one else can make this decision for him. No one else can wield the saw blade. For me, not even the pain of giving birth to my son could compare to the pain of leaving the meeting, but I had to, or die spiritually, emotionally, mentally, all without ever knowing who Jesus is, my brother and friend, not only my Lord and Savior."
I know for me personally, being read out and barred from taking communion and officially shunned globally by my birth culture was a deep, traumatic shock, a forcible uprooting that I can't really convey to anyone. I never will be able to explain what it feels like to have that done to you. You don't know who you are anymore for a while, once your church has judged you an unperson. Hard to think of yourselves as a Christian at all at first. And you know no one's ever going to date you. I've felt most understood when talking to Orthodox Jews and Sikhs and Muslims who have westernized and stopped following the cultural restrictions their parents raised them under. For me, it was Star Trek VI and going to see live music. For one girl, it was bacon. For another, it was cutting her hair. For some guys, it was not fasting during Ramadan or else drinking a beer while watching hockey. Darlene writes,
"The meeting told me I had to be restored to their fellowship to be back in God's will. Yet when I tried to go back, I was constantly rejected."
I get why so many in people are terrified of ever doing anything that might make them have to go through all this, because I was one of those. For years, I showed up at meeting when it certainly wasn't doing me any spiritual good, mainly to keep my membership open. I wasn't wrong in thinking that once I was out, any opportunity of dating Brethren women was over. Any young in women I've dealt with romantically since have had to keep our connection a secret. And when people have become aware these ladies are talking to me, they have been repeatedly warned about me, and true to their training, they have all heeded that warning and buckered off. A few have married atheists instead of someone like me. Simpler. What atheists tend to say about the meeting seems to be less upsetting than what I do. Mary says that when a young Brethren woman is sneaking out the side door, so to speak, I'm the last person she can have on her arm if she wants to get out without notice and start living a life utterly unconnected to the meeting, but stay on good terms with her folks. But even when I'd been kicked out, I wanted back in terribly. Being cut loose was more freedom than I knew how to deal with. So even then, I came out to meetings from time to time. I sat in the back row where non-members and those under discipline had to sit. I asked back in numerous times. I apologized to everyone, in person and in writing and by telephone. I was told that I would never get back in, no matter what I said or did, so long as my brethren didn't feel they understood me. And they never had. Why couldn't I be quiet and get along? Why must I insist on tearing up the Lord's people? Why must I always be a servant of the enemy? Why was I like this? Why was I me? And they soon stopped returning my calls and letters entirely, which eventually made me lose heart in even sending them anything. The loss of that hope is what gave me the freedom to write stuff like this. It sure wouldn't help soften their hearts toward me. I never would have had the courage to do it so long as that sword was hanging over my head. But they've only got the one coping mechanism strategy, and they've used it, so that's it for them. They pushed the big red button. They're done with me. They're not Taylor Hale's brethren, so I don't have to worry about getting sued by them for telling my story. As I said, in my church culture, far more people have been kicked out or have left than remain in it. It used to be huge. Nowadays, it's mostly gone. And we out people have all got thoughts and feelings about the whole thing. And we've all got the internet. People tell us to be quiet on Facebook all the time. It's been very hard for many of us, but we're not supposed to talk about that. The people it really upsets are people carefully not dealing with their own feelings about the matter. Because it's also been hard for people who've stayed in, whether they were in favor of or opposed to all of the kicking out. It's difficult all around. There are, in many areas, so few brethren left. Ruth writes,
"The struggles and sacrifices I am intimate with are the girls for whom staying in meant almost guaranteed lifetime celibacy. 5 of the 8 girls of the circle with which I am familiar are still single and have no prospects of an eligible meeting guy taking an interest in them. There are so few choices inside the circle of acceptable brethren guys that a single failed dating relationship is often the death of hopes and dreams for a marriage and a family. Someone like me, who found happiness with a guy outside the brethren circle, is therefore a pariah, shunned not just for leaving the meeting, but for having a successful marriage outside the brethren paradigm."
Anne adds,
"I think there is compromise in being in a very small meeting that is not vibrant and is overloaded with old people who aren't that exciting or fun. Young people stay out of loyalty to those people and wish they could be part of something that was more fun or fulfilling.